The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good afternoon. Great to see you here. A beautiful autumn day. Now, a few years ago, my dear sweet auntie, a lovely lady, gave our family a book for me to read to our children. It's the story of Noah. And I've scanned some of the pages, and on the screen they'll be there. I read half of this book to my children, then closed it, put it in a filing cabinet, and has never seen the light of day again. As I read it, you might be able to understand why. Here we go, the story of Noah. Once there was a man called Noah. Noah worked hard. He and his three sons toiled in the fields from morning to night. But most people didn't like work. They preferred to have a good time. And when God saw this, he was not very pleased. And so God tells Noah and so his sons to build an ark, a big boat. And they're working very hard and so on, building the ark because God's going to destroy the world. And a page or two later, we're told, while they were working, other people came to see what they were doing. "Why are you wasting your time with that thing?" they said scornfully. "Come and enjoy yourselves." Noah and his family were too busy to reply. That is the time when I closed the book. Why? One more page, Craig. We'll go back to the one. Now, this is an outrageous picture here, isn't it? You've got a couple of girls with tambourines, look like they're dancing, a couple of people with a flute, musical instruments, some other people having a glass of wine and that kind of thing and actually enjoying themselves. And what does the caption say? But most people didn't like work. They preferred to have a good time. And when God saw this, he was not very pleased. Just raise your hand if you would prefer to have a good time rather than go to work. Yeah? Okay. You think, well, wait a minute. And I'm thinking, I'm supposed to read this to my little children and tell them that that's what God is like. What? Now, I know the two ladies, I won't say the name of the two ladies who wrote the book because for sure, you know, there's someone's daughter or son here or whatever. Now, I know you've got to simplify things for kids, but this isn't dumbing it down. This is totally wrong. Totally. Now, I don't know if you've read the story of Noah and the great flood that God sends. It's in Genesis, first book of the Bible, chapters 6 through to 9. But let me read you why it is that God says or decides that he will send this great flood. And it's certainly not that people like to have a good time. Here we are. "The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and full of violence." Evil, violence, cruelty, and so with pain in his heart, God reluctantly acts. Now, I want to ask you, what's your view of God? Could you have kept reading that to little kids and think, yeah, that's what... It's not the God of the Bible, and it's not the God of the Old Testament. I mean... The God of the Old Testament is the one who creates the man and then creates the woman and puts them together so they can become one flesh and says to them, "You're free to eat of any tree in this beautiful garden, anything you want, except one, any tree." The other great irony is, they wanted a party, so God was cranky with them. In the law of Moses, as the people are entering the promised land about 1300 BC, God actually tells them to tithe. To give 10% of their income. Now, one in 3 years, that tithe was to be like social security for people, for the poor, the widows, orphans, some people who needed support. But 2 out of 3 years, what they were to do was to take 10% of their income, and then if they couldn't carry it to the particular place that God had said, they could swap it for silver and then use that to buy whatever they wanted to have a massive party. True. And the party was to celebrate the goodness of God and how great life was. That's what God's like and wants. But I've got to say, unfortunately, deep down in so many human hearts, this view of God, that somehow God's, well, the great killjoy in the sky, or God's the fun police and God wants us to be miserable, that's actually a view that many people have. And when you have that view, there's two possible reactions. We'll make them both start with the same letter. Let's pick the letter R. The first possible reaction is I've called rebellion, which basically says, well, God, if you're like that and you want life to be miserable, I have nothing to do with you, I'll ignore you, I'm out of here. And many, many people in our country do that. Don't give God a second thought, let's just go and ignore him. But the other possible reaction also starts with the letter R, and that is religion. I don't know if you've ever thought about that, but religion starts with the idea that, well, you know, God probably doesn't want us to enjoy ourselves, but how can we kind of strap on the burden and try and win God's favour? What kind of things can we do that will make God happy? And so people invent, you know, fastings and washings and pilgrimages and chanting, or you drift into asceticism, which is basically denying yourself pleasure to go without good food or to wear clothes that are either not warm enough or they're uncomfortable and so on. People deny marriage or deny sex within marriage and so on. And this is all, if we just deny ourselves pleasure, then that will make God happy. Or if people think, well, wait a minute, no, God really is a killjoy and kind of likes us to be miserable, let's share the misery around and let's make up a whole lot of extra rules that God hasn't made and try and get other people to obey them. So at different times, not everyone, but I've met people from different churches and so on who will say, you can't drink alcohol, you can't smoke, you can't eat meat, you can't watch television, you can't go to the movies, don't play cards, no rock music, don't dance, no makeup, no body piercing, you definitely can't go hunting, and there's all the Sabbath rules, but Ian Powell will come to that in a couple of weeks' time. The rules, to suck the joy out of life. Now, your average Aussie smells that and doesn't want anything to do with it. At different times, people who are like that have been called wowsers. Now, can you just kind of nod or indicate, have you heard the word wowser? Yeah, okay. Some of you young guys haven't. Might be a good thing. Let me explain to you where the word wowser comes from. It was a term used as kind of a temperance anti-alcohol slogan around the early 20th century in Australia, and it came from the acronym, We Only Want Social Evils Remedied. Okay, first letters make wowser. Here's a definition. In Australia, it's a derogatory word denoting a person who saps all the fun out of any given situation. Derived from the temperance movement in Australia and New Zealand at the turn of the 20th century, when it was hurled as an accusation towards conservative teetotalers who were too prim and proper to relax and socialise. Or a slightly more caustic definition, a religious freak, typically the sort who wants to ban fun in all forms. Now here's a Temperance League photo, and here's the girls with the sign that says, lips that touch liquor shall not touch ours. I don't know how well you can see the girls there, but gentlemen, I'd say that is a promise you'd want in writing. But to be a wowser means, maybe I shouldn't have said that out loud, to be a wowser is really to be the fun police, okay? And folks, when you have that view of God, that God doesn't really want us to enjoy life, and you've got to impress him somehow with all these rules and religion so easily rolls over into that. And you end up keeping rules and regulations to impress God, and guess what? If I can keep them better than you, then God will be more pleased with me, and so I can look down on you and kind of push you down a little bit, makes me look better. And it's also much easier to keep external rules than it is to really have a heart that's right towards God. Now, religion might look like that, but it's not Christianity. And it's not what Christ taught. And in front of you, in your program from Mark's Gospel, there are two stories, both to do with food. Well, the first one about food, the second one about lack of food. But both to do with food, and you see the beating heart of Jesus and how he relates to God and people, and let's see how different that is to the what I've called the religious worldview. So Mark chapter 2, verse 13. Once again, Jesus went out beside the lake. A large crowd came to him and he began to teach them. As he walked along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, Jesus told him. And Levi got up and followed him. Now it seems almost certain that Levi is actually the same man who's called Matthew in other parts of the Gospel. When you look at this same story told in Matthew's Gospel, he's called Matthew. when you look at the list of the 12 disciples that Jesus chose in Mark chapter 3, Levi's not mentioned, but Matthew is. So Levi's called by both those names. Capernaum was a big tax collection centre, so Levi, as he's called there, has been working in, as a tax collector. And I don't know if you're familiar with the New Testament, but basically the tax collectors were despised by the people of first century Israel. Why? They were Jewish men who had sold out to the occupying Roman army and collected taxes on behalf of the Romans and put a lot more in their own pockets or whatever they could squeeze out of the population. William Lane, who's a scholar on Mark's Gospel, says this: when a Jew entered the customs service, he was regarded as an outcast from society. He was disqualified as a judge or a witness in a court session. He was excommunicated from the synagogue, and in the eyes of the community, his disgrace extended to his family. You're seriously despised and an outcast. Now, as I've read a little bit this week, apparently they would even tax catches of fish at Capernaum, because it's right on the lake there. And it's quite possible that Levi knew the four disciples that Jesus has called so far, Simon and Andrew, James and John, and may well have known Jesus too. So Mark here just condenses it all into two words, really, follow me, but it was probably much more discussion and so on in that. But see, the remarkable thing in those first two verses is this: Levi gets up and follows Jesus, but even more remarkably, Jesus chooses this man who is an outcast in the eyes of the whole community, chooses him to be one of the people who are closest to him. All right, so what happens? Well, Levi is generous and turns on a meal. So verse 15. While Jesus was having dinner at Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners were eating with him and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. When the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they asked his disciples, why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? Okay, see verse 16 there, the name Pharisees. If you're not familiar with the New Testament, you know, the Pharisees pop up all the time in the Gospels. They were a religious group, really the religious leaders of the nation. They were laymen, not priests, but they took their religion very seriously. The word Pharisee derives from a Hebrew word meaning to separate or divide. And that's what they did. They separated from those who didn't take God seriously. They separated from those who didn't keep all the religious rules. And the Pharisees had made all sorts of religious rules about how what you had to do to serve God or keep him happy. Okay, so that's Pharisees. You see the other word about tax collectors and sinners. When they use the word sinner, they don't mean it in the Christian sense where, you know, if you've heard Christians speak, it's, we're all sinners, meaning we all do stuff we know is wrong and, you know, we all can't live up to our own moral standards. When they say sinners, what they mean is this: people who didn't keep the purity laws, people who didn't keep the traditions the Pharisees had made up, there's all sorts of things, washings and tithings and I'll read it to you. Mark later on tells us this: the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the tradition of the elders. It's nothing to do with germs. It's washing to please God by this ceremony. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash, and they observe many other traditions, such as the washing of cups, pitchers and kettles. So the Pharisees and teachers of the law asked Jesus, why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders, instead of eating their food with unclean hands? Now you notice all of these rules and regulations are the tradition of the elders. They're not out of the Old Testament. They've been made up in previous generations by these people. So how do you please God? The Pharisees are saying the way you please God is you make up all these traditions and then you separate from people who don't keep the rules. And unfortunately, there's enough of this has leaked into, inverted commas, parts of Christianity or into the religious world where people still think that's what it means to be a Christian. To separate. In 2006, I was asked if I'd take a particular role in the Anglican Church here in Sydney. I was appointed a bishop. And it was interesting that one of my friends who's been in jail for a long time, he's doing a very long sentence, and I write to him every couple of months. He writes back. We're still in touch. But his reaction when I got this particular job was interesting. Let me read you what he says back in 2006 when he wrote to me. He said this: I must bring this up on your new appointment, and that is our relationship, as I have already brought you and your family enough shame, embarrassment, disappointment, certainly not wanting to bring you any more, especially now you're going to become a bishop, as I don't want you to become under any scrutiny because of me and my life. If it is for the better that you cease contact, I fully understand and respect you. Yes, I know you're your own man, but even though I don't know God, you and your church and the people who will be listening to you, it just may not be good for you to have someone like me. I simply must ask. I wrote back to him and said, mate, it's not about that. Let me try, you know, for the 100th time to explain what it means to be a Christian. But it's often how people see that, isn't it? Now, there are Christians who do that, who behave this way. There are people who, anyone who does this hasn't understood what Jesus was on about. And no one who treats people this way actually gets it, what Jesus is like. Because Jesus is very different. Interesting that the group that Jesus debates with most, that he's most critical of in the whole New Testament, are the Pharisees. The deeply religious are the ones who, they're the ones who crucify him in the end. Listen to what he says about the mistake that they'd made. He says this in Matthew chapter 23. He says, woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill and cumin. So they had to give 10% of their income. They'd go out to their garden box and pick every tenth mint leaf. Okay, that's the level of rule keeping they had. He says, but you've neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, faithfulness. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former. And so, you've got these people here who are saying, why does he eat with sinners? And then in the next chapter of Mark's Gospel, they're planning to kill him. Jesus is driven not by external purity, by all these rules and regulations, but actually by compassion for people. Do you see verse 17? On hearing this, okay, Mark chapter 2, 17, on hearing this, Jesus said to them, it's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners. Now, almost certainly when he says the righteous, he means, as he's talking to them, he means the self-righteous. But you see what he says it means to be a sinner? It's not that you don't wash your hands. It's not that you didn't wash a plate. It's that you're spiritually sick. So to be spiritually sick is to be a sinner, or to be a sinner is to be spiritually sick. And to set out to say, I'm going to be good enough to impress God, we can't do that. We're not able to do it. And we know, if we really look inside, we know we're spiritually sick. The default setting of the human heart is selfishness. It really is. And I've never met anyone that says that they live up to even their own moral standards. We fall short of our own, let alone God's. We know we're spiritually sick, if we're honest. Now, last week, we looked at the story about Jesus and the four men ripping open the roof in the house and lowering down the guy who was paralyzed on the stretcher. And Jesus heals him, yes, physically, but first he heals him spiritually. And what does he do? He forgives him. He forgives all the wrong that he's done. He brings friendship with God. And folks, isn't that what we need to be healed that way, to be forgiven, to have friendship with God, to have our hearts changed so that we actually want to obey him? So Jesus doesn't separate from people. He actually kind of engages with people and offers forgiveness. Now, that's the first story about eating and the difference between Jesus and religion. See, the second story is about, about absence of food, really. See, verse 18, now John's disciples, meaning John the Baptist, Jesus' cousin, now John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. Some people came and asked Jesus, how is it that John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees are fasting, but yours are not? Now, fast is the idea of going without food, generally food rather than food and drink in the Bible, but the idea of going without food and or drink for a certain period of time. In the Old Testament, there's only one fast that's legislated, or only one fast that the people of Israel are told to keep, and that's on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, once a year. Now, there's other times when people fast in the Old Testament, and it's usually related to a really fervent prayer. You know, the earnest prayer for a particular thing that's on the heart, and you'd fast to help focus the mind on prayer and so on. And fasting teaches, you know, humility before God, makes us aware of our own frailty and so on. It's a good thing. But it very easily rolls over into just being a ritual that's gone through. And then it's worthless. I'll show you. In the Old Testament, the prophet Isaiah writes about 800 BC, and the spiritual life of the nation of Israel is very sick. And Isaiah, or God through Isaiah, is on about that again and again. Listen to what he says about people and their attitude to fasting. He says this, or God speaking, "Why have we fasted, they say, and you," that's God, "why," they say, "and you, God, have not seen it? Why have we humbled ourselves and you've not noticed? Yet on the day of your fasting, you do as you please and exploit all your workers. Your fasting ends in quarrelling and strife and striking each other with wicked fists. You cannot fast as you do today and expect your voice to be heard on high." In other words, it was just this ritual they went through while they were mistreating people and so on. By the time you get to the New Testament, the Pharisees had actually changed once a year fasting into twice a week. 2 days a week they fasted, but it had become really just a show in front of other people. So Jesus tells the parable about the Pharisee and the tax collector. Here it is. "The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself, 'God, I thank you that I am not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. Thank you, God, that I'm such a good man.'" Now, look at Jesus' answer about fasting. It's quite different to what you might expect. So you see, verse 18, now John's disciples and the Pharisees are fasting, and people come and ask why. Why don't Jesus' disciples fast? Well, you can understand why John the Baptist's disciples are fasting. They're no doubt praying, they're grieving because their mentor, John the Baptist, has been arrested by King Herod. You find out in chapter 6 that he's about to be executed. But look at Jesus' answer. It's quite different. Verse 19, Jesus answered, "How can the guests of the bridegroom fast while he's with them? They cannot, so long as they have him with them. But the time..." I'll just do 19. "How can the guests of the bridegroom fast while he's with them? They cannot, so long as they have him with them." In other words, he's saying, when you're at a wedding or a giant party and the bridegroom's with you and you're feasting, how could you possibly fast at a wedding? It doesn't work. And I'm here, the party's on. What was the great criticism of the religious people of the day? What was the great criticism they had of Jesus? And that is, he liked to party too much. He liked a glass of wine and he liked good food and he liked good company and he enjoyed himself too much. And that's their great criticism of Jesus. And what's Jesus say? "I've come to bring joy. And I'm here. How could they fast?" Now, verse 20, "But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them, and on that day they will fast." Possibly the first echo of the crucifixion in Mark's gospel, that Jesus will be taken away. A little hard to know, does he mean that it'll be taken away just for those few days between the crucifixion and the resurrection, and the disciples would fast then? No doubt they did. They were traumatized. Or does he mean when he's not physically with his disciples, not physically with his followers for, you know, 2,000 years, and in that time people will fast? Could be either. What is noticeable, though, is that the New Testament speaks about fasting fairly rarely. Fasting is mentioned after this a couple of times in the book of Acts about the Jesus apostles kind of fasting and praying. Jesus says, if you want to fast, that's fine, but make sure it's just between you and God. Don't tell anyone. That way it's genuinely sincere between you and God. So fasting is, if it helps you as you pray, if it teaches you humility, great. But in Christianity, it's not compulsory. and it's actually not that significant. It's certainly not mandatory like it is in some other religions. And you notice what Jesus says then. Look at 21:22. What does he mean? In the context, it's not hard to understand. He's speaking to those who've invented a whole lot of rules and regulations and washings and fastings and so on. And look what he says to them, verse 21. No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the new piece will pull away from the old, making the tear worse. And no one pours new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the wine will burst the skins, and both the wine and the wineskins will be ruined. No, he puts new wine into new wineskins. And what's he mean? The new cloth on an old coat or something doesn't work. Okay, not hard to understand that. The wineskin thing, the way they'd make a wineskin usually was it'd actually skin an animal. You know, cut the legs and the neck and so on, and then pull the skin off the animal in one piece, turn it back the right way, sew up the legs, etc., and then you've got your kind of, you know, ready-made wine cask. A little more character than the alfoil ones that you carry around today. But over time, the leather, the skin, would actually get brittle and weak, and if you poured new wine that was still fermenting, it'd burst. Now, what's Jesus saying? I think he's saying this. What he has come to bring is something new and different. And you cannot just pour what Jesus is bringing into their religious rituals and so on, and or you can't just kind of patch it on. This is new and different and bigger, and you can't relate to God on the basis of these rituals and traditions and so on. Because if you do, I'll tell you what happens. It ends up either tokenism, throwing God a bone now and then, or it leads to being self-righteous if you con yourself, or if you really look deep inside, it leads to despair. And this is not a great title for today's talk. I called it Why is Religion So Often Ugly? The trouble is that's an ugly title. I realised later what I should have called it is Jesus' Great Alternative to Religion. Because what does Jesus do? Jesus offers to heal the spiritually sick, to forgive us, and to bring compassion and love for people and joy and generosity and freedom. And he invites us to come and know him. It's a good question. If what Jesus offers is new and different, why does Jesus say he didn't come to destroy the law but to fulfill it? Very good question. He says that in Matthew chapter 5 in the Sermon on the Mount. One of the answers is this, I think. The essence of what the Pharisees did was to add to the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, God wanted people to fundamentally trust him. That was the great thing about Abraham and so on, that Abraham believed God and trusted him. So the basis of relating to God in the Old Testament was trust, right, and then to live the way that God had said. Even the sacrificial system, okay, they did that, but that was actually trusting God that doing these things meant that God would forgive you. Now, I think that what Jesus is particularly talking about here is the difference between the tradition of the elders and the command of God. I'll read to you. In Matthew chapter 15, Jesus is in another one of many hot debates with the Pharisees, and they come to him and say, how come you don't do the washings and the traditions? So then some of the Pharisees and teachers of the law came to Jesus from Jerusalem and asked, why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? They don't wash their hands before they eat. Okay, well, how come you don't keep the tradition of the elders? And Jesus replied, and why do you break the command of God for the sake of your tradition? For God said, honour your father and mother, and they were using kind of legal technicalities to not actually care for their parents financially. So Jesus keeps drawing a big difference between the command of God in the Old Testament and their rules and regulations and everything they've made up. I think that's the heart of what he's saying here about you can't match what you've got and what I'm bringing. I think that's the case. Anyone want to... late arriving mail. Thanks, Tor. Okay. Why did God choose the Israelites and not everyone else? Old Testament. Why did Jesus choose Levi to follow him? New Testament. How can I relate the above If I'm talking to someone who's not a Christian, about people choosing God and God choosing the person. Okay. All right. First one. Why did Jesus choose Levi? I have no idea. Why him particularly? But it is Jesus demonstrating that he had come to call sinners rather than the self-righteous. Okay. Also remember, though, that Nicodemus in John chapter 3 is a Pharisee and he becomes a believer in Jesus. Okay, so it wasn't that Jesus is against the religious people. Anyone who would come and ask for forgiveness got forgiven. Anyone who would trust him could follow him. Why did God choose the Israelites and not everyone else? It's not so much that God chose the Israelites, it's God chose Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, and God promised Abraham that if Abraham would trust him, come with him out of Ur, the town he lived in, come to the land, the promised land, the land of Canaan, that God would make him into a great nation. God would give him a great name. God would give him a land, and that out of Abraham's descendants, the whole world would be blessed. And so the story of the Bible is really God keeping those promises to Abraham, creating the nation of Israel, and out of Israel, salvation coming to the whole world in the person of Jesus. Okay? And so Abraham trusts God, yes, and God keeps his promises. How can I relate the above, if I'm someone who's not a Christian, about people choosing God and God choosing the person? Okay, we've got a couple of minutes. 2 minutes, righto. The Bible holds two great truths together and doesn't let go of either one. And that is this, that people are responsible for how they respond to God, and God will hold us accountable. And God will hold us accountable on the basis of what we've done and also on the basis of how much we've known. Okay? So someone hears the message of Jesus and then they'll say yes or no, and so God will hold us responsible. The other side of it is that God is in control, and the natural response of people will be to say no. And the Bible tells us that God in his mercy opens the hearts and minds of some people so they can understand who Jesus is. It's not kind of drags them in kicking and screaming against their will. God opens people's hearts and minds to understand who Jesus is. And you've got the two of those together. God takes the initiative and shows people and so on, and at the same time, people are responsible for their choices. You think, well, wait a minute, which one is it? Is it God's in control of that, or are we responsible? And the Bible never lets go of either. And as you look at life, it makes sense. I see God step in and open the hearts and minds of some people so they can see. And if you can see who Jesus is, or if you're even suspecting that this is true, God's at work in your life. I see other people who see other people who hear and say no. And yet both those truths together. Someone else want to follow that up? If you're really wrestling with that idea in the Bible, I can give you something to read, recommend a book, but you really tapped into one of the great themes of the Bible.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.